the discussions. So you heard a lot of different things there. You heard about some social issues, social justice issues. You heard about sort of an engineer's view of how things can be improved. And then you heard a more sort of scientific take on tackling challenges of food security. Now, of course, we recognize that countries like Canada produce much more food already than anyone in the country can eat. And we also recognize that many people in this country are food and nutrition insecure. And so there is always a balance between the technological advancements and ways we can grow more food for more people and the distribution and social justice issues and the equity issues that I raised earlier around sustainability, which all have to come together. And maybe when you think about some of the questions now that I'd like you to pose to our panel, I urge you to stretch them and get the most out of the time. We have about 25 minutes. I'd like to invite the panel, the speakers to the stage and invite anyone who has questions on anything related to what was raised or even other questions that these experts may be able to help you with. Please take the microphone.
Good morning. Thanks very much for the presentations. It was like too much for my brain to process at the same time, a lot of information. So I just want to have like a summary, like in a short, because we were told in our development, our project development class, that if you want to solve a problem, you need to identify the problem, you need to incorporate the community into the problem, and you need to check how resilient the population is to your violent solutions. So I really want to know, with respect to your point of views, like you guys had amazing topics, like tomorrow's farming, smart agriculture, and today, tomorrow, it was like very innovative. I was like, I was living in a dream. So I really want to know how you guys are going to target your problem. What are the problems that you are really focusing on? How do you intend to incorporate the community into the problem? How do you intend to match the resilience of the population to your kind of technology you're bringing? Because some are really hyper-tech, and I don't think if you carry that to a rural place, they might just get lost with the technology. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Let's start at the end there, if you may. Just a question about involving the end users.
Right, thank you very much. It's a good question. So the problem is that are we using resources appropriately? Like it's just efficiency of we got to whatever we put into agricultural production system, we got to get out. So when we're talking about benefits of that can pay for the technologies, where are we getting it? We are fishing it out of St. Lawrence River. That's pretty much, or any other water body where we have unused fertilizer washed away or going through groundwaters and so on. So when we have ability to assess what's actually happening and where and when, we can adjust our management practice accordingly. And normally when we go with technology, it allows us to see mistakes that traditionally has been done. Normally when we start with brand new operation, like looking at different components, we start with technology, we go to conservation tillage, we go to different areas, even optimized financial management that's can be appropriate. Another important part is social aspect. Farming is a difficult task, and now with this technology, operators who still are inside combine and tractor but don't need to steer all the time, they are not as stressed. They can extend hours. They can have less responsible labor also involved and basically get a quality output from less demand in terms of physical stress, in terms of financial load and things like that.
Okay. With respect to developing new crops, I think one of the key people that we talk to are the breeders who develop the crops, as well as, you know, the producers who grow them. I didn't mention it in my presentation, but for most of the major crops now, they have producer groups, producer associations, and that's something, at least within Canada, that these people now have much more of a voice. They have more input. They want to have more input into sort of the way that the crops are being sort of geared and developed, down the road. And they have a wealth of knowledge because these are the people, they're on the ground. They're the ones that are growing it. So it's definitely a lot of feedback from them, as well as the companies that sell the seeds and that ultimately we may be working with.
Your question was, how do you involve communities? And I'll put it the other way. How do you get involved and involve yourself with those communities? I just was going to check with the audience. How many of you have got connections with farming, directly or indirectly? Okay. How many of you have worked in rural areas and lived? Okay. So one way to understand farmers is to work with them where they live. I often complain to my urban friends that I'm more often in town than they are in country areas. When I was living only 3 hours away from Brisbane, I call that suburban, right? We're only 3 hours away from Brisbane. A lot of friends didn't want to come because they didn't think there was much to do in the rural areas. And I told them there were 16 wineries, and I got a few more coming. But I agree with the previous speakers. Farmers in developing countries know and can identify the problem. It's a matter of going to them rather than you waiting for them to come to you. So living there and understanding the social context of their problem is important. And I can only encourage all of you to work in rural areas as much as you can, and then come to urban areas and network and all that, but have that experience. I'm very pleased to say that in the 20 or 25 years that I've worked in Africa or Asia, I've seen a lot more now African leaders, scientists, trainers, a lot of women and a lot of men who are now the consultants, the advisors, and it's local people doing it. And that's really positive. So you guys have got that future in your hands. It's just a matter of having a chat with those people in their own villages, in their own settings.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Kim Matthew. I'm from the McGill School of Environment. So my concern is that there seems to be a lot of new technology that focuses on specific plants. I'm not saying all the technology you were outlining focuses on one specific crop, but a lot of it seems to be very narrowed on how to improve this crop and how to improve this other crop. I'm raising the worry that this might encourage monocropping, and I'm wondering what you guys think about this and if with your studies you believe that it actually does encourage monocropping in terms of the investment from the farmer and the technology that you have and if it's appropriate for multiple crops on one field.
Thank you. This is an excellent point, and actually would disagree. The technology actually suggests other way around, because we are not talking about one specific set of technologies. We are talking about system approach. So now suddenly we have access to a variety of data that we can involve such tools like risk management, which normally it would be quite difficult to comprehend. You need to have very good intuition or practice, and in changing market environment, changing climatic conditions, so on, it's quite complicated. But when you have data to support your intuitive beliefs, then we see people going into diversification, going into different cropping systems. And if you want to implement conservation practices like no-till and so on, you can't go without encouraging a diversified cropping production system and make sure that you have sustainable environment to work with.
Yeah, that's a good question. By and large, agriculture in Canada and agriculture in North America is monoculture. And really a lot of the efforts are to be able to do that sustainably. One of the key aspects that we do there is the crop rotation, so that every year you change it. So culturing many crops all at the same time, I think would be nice. It would be good. I'm not sure, this is outside of my area of expertise, but I'm pretty sure that we wouldn't be able to get the amount of productivity that we get out right now. And that's, you know, the part of the resistance, or a lot of the resistance to doing that. So with the monocultures, how can we do that as sustainably as possible?
I like your question very much for two or three reasons, and I might come at from a different angle. I don't agree that it's only the existing systems that we need to continue. Three points. In Africa and in Asia, there's a wealth of vegetables, and it's taken over 25 years to recognize the nutritious values of those vegetables. And I was very pleased to read recently that in Kenya there's an indigenous vegetable breeding center that is led by a woman. She's got the job that I thought should have been done 20 or 25 years ago, with leaf vegetables, local vegetables and fruits. They're sturdy, they're adapted to the climate and the soils. And very importantly, the Western world also want those, because people want new tastes, new tastes, and are very worldly. Your generation travels a lot more and love those new foods as well. So there's also a potential for overseas export. That's the first one. And I've worked with a lot of agronomists with computers, and when they provide advice to farmers, they have to simplify it. So it's simple for them to say, well, we need to do this crop rotation, because that's what we can manage. And as a result, it's for Australia, it was maize, sorghum, and wheat, and in rotation. But over 10 years, we had yield plateaus. We had chemical resistance because we were using the same products on the same crops and little variety. So I think we have an ethical... It's the first time I think my ethics in agronomy started being questioned, because our decision support tools were providing dangerous advice. We were leading into some chemical resistance and monoculture issues there, and biodiversity issues, and God bless us if there is a big disease that wipes out wheat crops like it has happened in the past. So I think you have a point, and we have un devoir, we have an ethical...
Responsibility
to be cautious about the number of crops that we grow, and we can't rely just on five main cereals to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we could have a whole conference on this debate of sort of, and I think it raises really important points that we could think through collectively and chat over lunch. The sort of is agriculture an economic activity, or is it more? So this side.
Thank you very much. I thank the presenters. My question is going directly to the first speaker. You raised, there was a point you made, which I would like to rebrand the point and ask it this way. I think it's about what you mentioned, it's about data war. You envisage that if the data is not well disseminated, it's going to create something like data war. Like when I have information about a piece of land that is maybe high in nitrogen or high in phosphorus, if I don't share it where, or if a land is maybe is contaminated with heavy metals and I don't share it well, it might make people not be interested in that farmer, in that area of land, because there are a lot of heavy metals in the land, so they will not buy the product from that land, which is data that should help. It's not turning to be something that is turning against the farmer, because my land has been mapped out as a land filled with heavy metals, which is a very big concern that you raise. So my question is, how do you think this data the researchers should disseminate the data so that it will not turn to something that would bite the farmer?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a difficult question. I'll give you examples. In Australia, cattle used to be dipped in arsenic for ticks and things like that, and those areas can be contaminated now. So that's an issue. If you've got a contaminated area on your land, then your land value goes down because of that. Or if you've got salinity and people see it on maps, it goes down. We will know with the precision ag the potential of some land, and so it's got impacts on the price of land because you know the potential, the growing potential. I'm more concerned, and it's not new, land speculation and commodity trading speculation. It has happened during the World War. You know, we had satellites going over Russian fields to determine the price of wheat. So these things are not new. We can just access them quicker. And my concern is just at a farmer's level, yeah, how do you protect and give farmers a right to defend the value of their land? You know, it's a commercial transaction. But at a higher level, how do you avoid, because now it's computers doing trading in futures. I've got shares. I know it's not necessarily people. It's also nanocomputers. How do you avoid nanocomputers doing commodity trading and food speculation? So they're the issues that we just need to keep a conscious social concern about. But data is power, you know. Data is power. But farmers know the potential of land of their neighbours. They don't need satellite imagery, but other buyers will use it to determine that in the future. It's not necessarily wars. It's just a commercial additional advantage.
Do you mind if I finish on time? Did you
quick follow?
Quick point.
Yeah. I just like to follow up. In the world of precision agriculture, data security has been a very long discussed issue because how do you protect identity of where data coming from? And when we talk to software companies about the issue, and they like, what's the problem? You're still using email on a server that you don't know where it belongs, and some of information in your email might be even more sensitive than the data that you're trying to protect. But the key issue that we are missing, and data protection is actually achievable through the architecture of the software, but the key benefit is that we can learn from each other. So once we have a little pool of data here, but if you combine together and have some original aspects, then maybe there is a added value on the information and can be benefited by everybody in the community.
Can I just add a point, just a solution, though. It's not all negative. Technology, I must add, we've used it positively. And I'll just give you an example. In cotton-growing areas or cane-growing areas, there were issues with pesticides in Canada. I'm sure you do the same. We use planes to spread chemicals, and some people were having concerns with spraying over roofs and schools and things like that. The technology allowed us to, working with the agronomists, to know where the pollution was coming from and to go in a safe environment, and the agronomist and the farmer would sit down and the agronomist would say, listen, we know it's coming from your farm. And for them, it's an issue because they're losing fertilizers, they're losing chemicals, so they're losing money, but they don't want to lose their reputation either. So the agronomists and consultants would do it in a safe, private environment, and the farmer would change his practice. And as a result, there was less pesticides altogether. Or in France, I worked on nitrates. The farmers could prove that it wasn't them polluting the nitrates and pesticides. It was local government spraying the roads in spring or during winter, and the chemicals were in the water. So farmers could defend their record, so it can vindicate their record as well. So it's not all negative. The technology can be used both ways, and it can empower farmers to defend their record as well.
Interesting issues.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a quick two-part question for Pierre Faubert. And the first part is regarding double haploidy and whether there is potential issues regarding aneuploidy and genetic mutations, or if there is further down the line, and how to address that with people who might already have concerns with, you know, like GMOs and mutation. And my second question is regarding genomics. And while genomics can give us a diverse a wealth of genetic information, it might expose desirable genes but also undesirable genes. So is there a possibility of loss of biodiversity as we latch on to the more desirable plant breeds?
So with the first question, with the double haploidy, you can get things like aneuploidy. So we generally will sort of have protocols to look for those things. And generally speaking, a lot of the plants that are aneuploid may not be as fit And so we would, we'd get rid of those. So I don't think that that's a really big problem. Like, as I mentioned, I would say almost all of the canola crops that are, not all, but a large amount of the canola crops that are in the field right now, and as well as other species, are produced through double haploidy technology. With respect to the diversity and biodiversity, most people predict that we'll actually increase the diversity of the crops that are out there. And the reason for that is because it becomes a lot easier to identify and to introduce from sort of that broader gene pool. So the older varieties that are no longer in agriculture or relatives of the plant species. So the biodiversity is going up. And again, the farming culture and field is very aware of the potential pitfalls of reducing the biodiversity. And this is a way to sort of actually monitor it and make sure that we can improve it as much as we can.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Ruby. I'm currently an agriculture economics student at Laval University. My question is directed to Mrs. Valerie Sapin. You talked about land grabbing in the sense that governments or private corporations will invest in other countries. I was wondering if you have a comment about local private companies that would invest here to buy land, and there's no even proof that it will be used for agriculture, and it seems more like a speculation. For example, the National Bank buying thousands of hectares in Quebec. I was wondering if you have a point, like what could be the impact on food security locally, and also if you think government should intervene in terms of policy to set that up. Thank you.
It's a very good question. It's a hard one. First thing, in Australia, there's never been enough local domestic saving to develop agriculture. So a country like Australia, and I suspect Canada might be a bit like that, Australia has always relied on foreign investments. It has been Japanese money that has built Sydney, and there's been Japanese money to buy farms or lease farms in the past. It's not all bad. It's not necessarily all bad. I don't know the situation enough well in Canada. I know the Canadian, or the La Caisse des Dépôts du Québec bought investments in Australia. I think they're trying to do it for their investors, for people who have retirement funds as well. And it's a long-term investment, thinking that food will be good business. It's important to have investment in agriculture and developments. And sometimes they help develop the infrastructure, and the local farmers do not have the money to do so. So I don't know, to be honest, there's probably somebody better aware of the NAB situation in Canada. But I know that people are looking for solutions. There's a scheme called the Panga Lease Scheme, which is an investment scheme. You obviously nodding your head. So it's investors buying land and then leasing it back to young people. I believe in that type of scheme because it helps young people access land and only pay a rent and minimize their risk and put their money in technology and development. And it's the financial leases, finances who are taking the capital risk. So it'll depend on the models. But there might be other people in the room on that point.
I think it raises an interesting question for how agriculture might change in the future. Next question.
Hi, my name is Kate Sinclair, and I'm a PhD student here at McGill. I have two questions. First, I was wondering, for the first speaker, what your thoughts are on the implications for those who are employed in the agriculture industry right now with these technologies. And second, with Mr. Faubert, as we invest in these GMO technologies, I'm wondering if we're equally looking at the potential nutrition implications of these technologies. As we've seen throughout the conference, it's not just food security, but food and nutrition security and the quality of the food we're eating.
So with your focus question on the implications for workers, do you want to clarify or be a bit more specific?
Just wondering if this might take away jobs from some of the people who, working in agriculture.
The current technologies? What might take away?
This is moved to smaller scale farmers in developing countries. You just briefly touched on it at the end of your presentation. If there might be implications for those working in that industry, whether they have a job or if jobs will be lost.
I think there's room for a lot of people in agriculture, and I think the working conditions, I hope, for Africa and Asia and elsewhere, they need to improve. We need to have mechanized tools for women, you know, talking about cultural issues. Mechanization helps attract young people as well in any country. We need to have that technology for young people, for women, improve the working conditions. You know, I've tried hoeing with women. I couldn't last 10 minutes, and they would do it all day, all year, and all that. Their conditions need to change. I think agriculture is a fantastic career and work, and I think I hope there's going to be more synergies from the IT world coming to agriculture. I've got friends, farmers. They're not hiring cattlemen anymore. Their next hire was an IT guy from Ireland because that's what they needed. And for women, for young women, for you guys, it's a fantastic career. You have 20 jobs in there. You can change countries. And I think it's a fantastic profession.
Right, with GMO and nutrition, again, GMO is a tool, and it can definitely be used for those purposes. The prime example that comes to mind is golden rice, which increases the levels of vitamin A, where vitamin A is deficient. There's so many people that suffer from deficiency of vitamin A, and through GMO technologies, they've been able to produce rice that has much higher level. So this is definitely possible. I think very often what happens in terms of the nutrients is, especially in the West, is people start developing crops that have good agronomic properties. Tomatoes would be a good example of that, where the firmness and the fact that they can be shipped to different areas is high on their priority list, whereas the taste of the tomato seems to fall on the back burner or whatever. So again, I don't see that GMO in itself is going to be something that's going to take away from any of the nutrients or any of the the positive aspects of food, and can be used to enhance it.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so we need to break for lunch. Gentlemen's been waiting a long time, so you get to ask the last question.
Very briefly.
Apologies for the missed opportunity here.
Very, very briefly. My name is Eduardo Quiroga. I'm a consultant in agriculture. Just came back from Southern Africa, where I was doing an evaluation of climate change adaptation for subsistence farmers. So I have some general remarks that I want to share with you. The first is that this approach of saying we'll try out this technology doesn't work. This was done there in Southern Africa, where I went, half a dozen technologies. Farmers didn't take it. The reason is what we said, the IFA president, farmers are too smart. They're not going to jump into a technology that hasn't been tested before. The second aspect is that there's a lot of technologies that you mentioned that are very useful, immediately as I can see. But testing out that those are useful in the field is costly. It's not free. Maybe IFA would be interested in selecting some of the technologies you identified. And the third thing is, actually, nutrition seems to be vital, but not in terms of how many grams of this, how many grams of that, but actual foods. How you prepare those foods on the ground. Women in Africa, you know that very well, and I do, and that's measuring what is protein, what is vitamin A. All they know is foods. And all they know is certain things, how they cook. If you come up with another ingredient and they don't know how to cook, they won't do it. So these are the shared observations I had. Perhaps it will be useful for later on. Thank you.
Thank you. So a comment there about the need for sort of integrative approaches and where the left hand knows what the right hand's doing, so to speak. So thank you for that. Okay, so I'd like us to... Oh, did you want to respond to that quickly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
This is actually an excellent comment. And when we look at what the primary products coming out of precision agriculture, it's on-farm research. It's basically a trial that previously you need to set up lots. It's quite intensive, labor-intensive work and how information flows and so on. And right now you can get you can see response with one flight of drone and see if it's actually working or not. We normally recommend if you're not sure what to do, just try to do both at the same time. One, like what you normally do everywhere, what you're trying to do in small area, and see if you can identify the difference. If you can, then you do the math. If you cannot, do what's cheaper. Same goes to sensitivity to different input parameters. Like African example, looked in a few cases, and a lot of times people go into what the soil test values and so on, but at the end, it's all coming to the availability of funds, availability of material. A lot of times we just don't have material. So what technology allows to do is to see where we would have the biggest response on the investment of resources that we have. It's just simple optimization problem. Well, not simple, optimization problem.
Right. Thank you.
With that, we'll break for lunch. Thank you very much to all our speakers for their interesting and quite diverse topics. Yeah. Okay, should we ask?
Yes, we have, before we go for lunch, I want to remind you that we want to be back in this room for the next session at 1:30. But before we do that, we have an announcement. Valerie, please.
And with Hugo's permission, I just asked him because it's a new course that we're offering at McGill, and we haven't had a chance to market it enough. There's a new course in agribusiness, entrepreneurship and innovation that is starting in January at the McDonald campus in line with this hotel management. And it's looking at helping people who are interested in their own business or in working in agribusiness and innovation and understanding what it takes to manage a small business in agriculture, urban agriculture, innovation and social innovation as well. So if any of you are interested, please talk to Eduardo or myself. I think Eduardo, he's around. He might be outside. But we're looking at organizing the course and the next intake of people. So thank you for letting me put a plug to that. Thank you. Buon appetito.